Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on.
Tennis.
51552 for your text. At Game on 2FM, we'll get this on Twitter, and we are going to chat tennis. And Stephen Higgins from crosscourtview.com is with us in studio. How are you?
Very good.
You were the one who said you don't want to grow up and be Gary Neville, so I can just...
All right. Yeah. Well, I was actually just paraphrasing. That's what Jamie Carragher said.
Well, now you see, before people text in and start criticising me now, you know, I'm a tribute to comment and I'm speaking in jest.
Fair enough.
How good a US Open across the board did we just see?
It was a bit messy, actually. I think the finals possibly rescued it. I was thinking throughout it when Djokovic's shoulder problem forced him to go out. Federer, which is really unusual, as you actually saw, he finished the match because Federer, I don't think he's ever retired in an official match in his entire career, even though he was clearly injured at the end and could barely move with a back problem. That because it's the fourth major, they play so much, it's so hard-wearing on their bodies. And a lot of the, say, younger guys went out in the first round, Dominic Thiem, Zverev went out early, etc., that you're wondering was just the attritional nature of the tour had kind of wrecked the Grand Slam in a sense.
How strong a call has there been for the calendar to be reviewed? Because these guys appear to be running on empty.
The calendar is just all the time. But one of the things that, say, I think Federer has spoken about it, you know, 15 years ago, and Murray, and there's been a lot of politics off the court on the ATP Player Council, where Novak Djokovic was leading it, and there was controversy about the ATP CEO and then how he left. And then, amazingly, Nadal and Federer have come back like a dynamic duo of Batman and Robin, that they're going to join the Player Council together, probably, I suppose, in the twilight of their career to try see if they can make some changes that they're happy with. But the calendar, everything is about adding more events, adding more exhibitions, extending the calendar, when everything should be about reducing the calendar.
And the challenge that you have is the ATP and the broadcast companies and everything else, you know, let's be very honest, they don't look at Roger Federer or Novak Djokovic or Serena Williams or anyone else and see individuals. They see commodities and they see marketing and they see tickets sold, and he who pays the piper picks the tune. And, you know, player power, there's going to have to be some, not necessarily a revolt, but there's going to have to be a fairly grand sense of unity amongst the, not even the top players, because the top players can pick and choose to some extent what they play in, but the other guys that are clamouring 52 weeks of the year to try and make a living.
There's a lot of stuff going on in terms of there is a push for a players union. There isn't one at the moment. That's certainly on the agenda. I think that's what Djokovic wants. But from the tournament's perspective, it's probably important to say that most of them don't really make money, and they have to be well-funded to keep going. And if a tournament organiser, say, OK, Indian Wells, which is like the fifth biggest tournament in the world, Larry Ellison from Oracle runs that. He's a billionaire. He just funds that. He's made it into this incredible tournament. But for a lot of the tournaments, if their kind of objective is we want to make a big, you know, a huge event, a Master Series or a Premier level tournament, they have to put huge amount of money into all the infrastructure, into staffing, into all that kind of stuff. So they have long-term contracts. Like, say, when Miami redeveloped their entire facilities there recently, surely the deal is that we're putting all this money into the tournament because you're going to keep the tournament here for the next 25 years or so. And I'd say with a lot of those contracts, that's the issue, because there are tournaments where, say, Indian Wells is a fortnight tournament and Miami is a fortnight tournament. It would be better, in my opinion, if there wasn't Miami, if it was just Indian Wells and you had a break up to the clay court season. But if both tournaments have long-term contracts and they put lots of money in, you can't get rid of them.
No.
You know, they're set in stone, probably.
And yeah, and if you're one of the poor players who's struggling physically, get on with it, because that's the nature of the challenge that's been set. I suppose a word on the respective champions. Nadal, are we destined at this stage now, looking at physically where he and Federer are, that Nadal will eclipse him and become the greatest in the game ever seen?
I think, he's an absolute excellent chance of winning a 13th Roland Garros title next year. I think if Nadal turns up at 50, like 60% fit, he's a very good chance of winning Roland Garros. So, I mean, he will be favoured for that next year. On the greatest ever, I think the one thing with Nadal, when you see him, particularly compared to when he was a kid, is tactically he's probably the best of the three. The way he can adapt to players is extraordinary. And he's always had the physicality and all. But say when he played Kevin Anderson in the final a few years ago, he has a brilliant two-handed backhand, but he just sliced the whole time because Kevin Anderson's 6'8". He doesn't like going down. I can slice it, keep it low, get on my forehand, and then the forehand. The way he can come into serve and volley, as he did a lot against Medvedev, how he can find loads of different ways of winning and never gives up and keeps going. And the way, like, Medvedev had an outstanding final. And of all the next-gen younger guys, he put up the best performance I think I've seen against the guys in a Grand Slam, where he showed that, like, relentless intensity that you need. That's what the three guys show the whole time, is that we're going to be there every point. You're going to have to rip the trophy out of our hands. And he showed that. Like, he was down two sets and a break, and he kept going and kept going, and won another two sets against Rafael Nadal in a final, and made it so close in the fifth.
Imagine how good he'd be if everything was played on clay.
Yeah.
Have we seen the future of the women's game?
Yeah, I think of the younger gang, there's quite a lot of them. One of the great trends in women's tennis at the moment is a lot of players with variety. And Bianca Andreescu is certainly that. She just has an incredible set of tools in terms of her mobility, a huge forehand. Easily, as you could see against Serena, can last in the rallies no problem. Lots of variety in terms of she can slice, she can come into net. But probably most impressive, the fearlessness. She turned up to the final and she's like, I'm going to win this. Why wouldn't I win the US Open? Like, I should be winning the US Open.
But it was brilliant. And, you know, the fact that she talked about at some point this year, won a match and said, like, you know, was able to reflect upon that as the moment at which she decided she was going to win a Grand Slam and she was going to win. Dare I suggest that Serena was as slightly ungracious in victory. And I felt slightly sorry. I was watching a lot of, you know, the breakfast news programmes the morning after the final and listening to a lot of radio. And it all rotated around Serena has been beaten and Serena has come back from giving birth to her child and still hasn't won, and which is a very unfair narrative on one case. But Serena basically came out and went, like, I was crap. And the only reason she won was because I was crap. And if I'd played even half to what I could play, she'd have won. Or am I being harsh on Serena that it's just that's just the competitive nature that streaks in her, and she was probably never going to come out and go, I've just been beaten, fair play to this 19-year-old who's phenomenal and played me off the court.
I wish she would actually just concede. Like, that's now four finals. It was probably touch and go, maybe. Kerber had a great match at Wimbledon. Osaka was absolutely outstanding last year, and you had the big debacle around that where she was outplayed. Halep had one of her best performances ever at Wimbledon and again outplayed Serena. And then, yeah, Andreescu, I think that's actually, of the four finals, that was probably Serena at her best level of those four finals. Not maybe the level she used to be, but there's also a case that she wasn't allowed to be, because Andreescu she's beaten about 10 or 11 top 10 players this year already.
Is the aura gone? And like we've talked about this in golf, that there came a point at which guys went up against Tiger and they were beaten before a ball was hit, and then that changed and the mentality changed. And the aura around Serena...
Yeah, I don't think it's there. I think they're of that generation that she was around, Sharapova, Azarenka, who she has huge head-to-head records against, they would still probably go, as you saw with Sharapova in the first round, where it was just a blowout. But I think with the younger players, Serena's a victim of her success, where she's made all these players so good. And they come to finals and they're ruthless and they're not afraid of her. And I think what's impressive is they play the Serena Williams. They play the player across the net from them. They don't play the legend and the icon that you hear about. And with Serena, she hasn't had a good enough level in the four Grand Slam finals to make it. Clearly, she's affected by the chase, the pursuit of equaling Margaret Court in 24.
And it was interesting that her default setting on this now is, I'm not looking to equal a record. I'm looking to win 24, and then I'm going to look to win 25, and then I'm going to look to win 26. That she has a very strong narrative that she now introduces around her pursuit of not a record, but just future Grand Slams.
Yeah, I think the controlling of the narrative is one of the issues, really, in terms of, I think she likes when you get all the love on Instagram and the Queen and all that kind of stuff. And she has done extraordinary things, and she's come back from a lot of issues. But I think give credit to, she played a player who played better than she did. And it's again like Osaka, she played a player who played better than she did. And Halep. And I think it's great for the women's game that they're coming there fearless, just like, I'm here to win this.
And that's what we want. We want new heroes to invest in, and we want new stories and new territories. And like the shots from Canada in the early hours of the morning and what it meant is phenomenal. That's what you want to be seeing.
It's double the ratings of the men's final, I think, that match.
Well, there you go.
And already you have, you know, little girls watching on TV screen, Bianca Andreescu wins. Oh, I should play tennis. This is great. Yeah.
A couple of, I'm going to get a little bit tabloid now, but you'll forgive me. Medvedev, you made reference to him. He was like a WWF pantomime villain at matches, where he went from being like everyone's enemy to being everyone's favourite in the course of what felt like a week or 10 days.
Brilliant, yeah. Trolling the crowd of, he played, it started against Feliciano Lopez, known as Deliciano to his friends or to his admirers, as you say. If you go around the tournament, there's always an extra 1,000 people looking over a fence. It's usually for Feliciano Lopez.
Gary used to get that on the practice range at the golf.
All day, every day.
Yeah,
all day, every day.
It's a curve.
But he was playing Lopez. The crowd were much really in favour of the Spaniard. And then they started booing and supporting him. And then a camera showed him walking back to the baseline and putting the finger up at the side of his head. And then he did a really brilliant sarcastic interview afterwards. He's like, you know, I was really struggling here, but your energy got me through to the end. And the crowd all booing him. And he did the exact same thing the next round, where again, they were against him. And he said, like, oh, your energy, like, I was really struggling here, but got me through. But he conceded a bit in post-match interviews, you know, with the written press. And then, yeah, he was definitely making a statement in his interview, you know, I'm not that bad a guy. I was just kind of, you know.
But there's been a whole load of it. Like, we had more profanity in what is perceived to be this great gentleman and lady sport than we've had in any Grand Slam I can remember for quite some time.
Yeah, all these audible obscenities
nicer way of phrasing
there was
it.
There was a funny one with Yelena Ostapenko, the former French Open champion, where apparently she cursed. It was a debate whether she cursed at the back of the court. It was reported to the umpire. She said, I cursed in Latvian. How did the person know what it was or something like that? But apparently she curses in Russian as opposed to Latvian.
Right.
And then even Federer, the magnificent, even lost his cool a bit in a press conference when he was asked about whether his team requests that he plays at certain times and matches. And he kind of said, I'd had enough of this, etc.
But that's a valid question to ask.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because you look at the scheduling and he seems to come out on the better side of schedule. Now, I know people will say, why would you want to put him on at 1 o'clock in the morning when...
It's because he's Roger. That's the way
he draws in the crowd.
Yeah, you got to look after the stars. That's sport. Yeah.
There's also, say, if you're at Roland Garros, like, they always put on Nadal and Federer first on, say, Philippe Chatrier or Lange, because a lot of their corporate clients would have paid, you know, 500, 1,000, etc. to be there and were expecting Rafael Nadal or Roger Federer to be there. They move around other people around the different courts. But a lot of it is that, you know, their corporate hospitality, they have paid a fortune. The tournaments rely on that fortune.
And the same with the TV broadcasts.
Yeah, and exactly.
Nick Kyrgios, is he an art installation at this stage? Because, like, you know... I often say to my wife, I have a 3-year-old, 3.5-year-old at home, and I would love to spend a day in his head, but I think it would frighten me too much. And I think Kyrgios is pretty much on a par with my young lad, because he seems to operate in this parallel universe to reality.
I almost change my mind on him every point. Like, you know, I've gone from like, what does he do when he's ruining the game, to isn't he brilliant? Like the funny guy. His talent is still extraordinary, even in the run-up to the US Open when he won Washington. And the things he can do in tennis court are unique. But there's the mental stuff. He played against, say, Tsitsipas in a brilliant match, I think it was in Washington, and he destroyed Tsitsipas for a set and a half, actually just blew him off the court. And then a person in the crowd annoyed him for some reason, said something, and he just completely fell apart. Then the set just disappeared. He's like, oh, what's he saying, your man? And his concentration just like that goes. And also, unfortunately, the physical problems come in as well, where I think it's not, it doesn't look like it's possible for him to sustain the level through a Grand Slam, either physically or mentally, unless he finds some sort of steel like the big three.
But, you know, he's left to reflect on 6 career titles so far. He's quarterfinal of the Australian Open in 2015, quarterfinal of Wimbledon in 2014, his best Grand Slam. Like, is that a fair level of where he's at? Or is he a guy in, 24 years of age, that we will say in 6, 7, 8 years, what a wasted talent, because he let everything else get in the way?
Yeah, because people say it about Marat Safin, the former player, that he was a waste of talent. He got to world number one. He hammered Pete Sampras in the final of the US Open. He won the Australian Open.
He beat
Federer. I mean, it's like a waste of talent who got to number one in the world isn't the worst thing going. I think, with Kyrgios, I hope he doesn't kind of leave the sport at 26, wake up at 35 or something like that. Like, you know, this is his gift. And he is really gifted. He can do things that most people can't, including the big guys, you know, maybe not Federer, but...
You kind of worry about him when he does retire, how he's going to adapt to that environment as well, because he's been, you know, he's a bit of a loose cannon, but when, you know, when the dust settles and the sport's over, you know, how's he going to adapt? And they're the guys I'd worry, or the players I'd worry about afterwards.
When you look at the so-called Mavericks, like you look at Connors, McEnroe, you know, Ilie Nastase, all those guys over the years, they all have Grand Slams in their back pocket, whereas the Belnik has two quarterfinal appearances.
They can all pick their time, but it's also, it's that constant, the concentration, the relentless intensity of that, that he's a long way from that. And that's what you wish with him. I think Monfils a little bit, where it could you, you know, could you just give us a season or two where you're just like, okay, I'm just going to like focus on all these kinds of things. I'm just going to, you know, think like Djokovic and get see how high I can get up, how far I can get in the tournaments.
Now, as a final question, and I don't know that we've ever discussed fashion on the radio before.
Obviously not.
Sorry,
You're dressed for radio tonight.
Yes. Well, sorry, I dress for the life I have, not the life that I want. Adidas had a disaster. And it's funny how much this has been spoken about since that, okay, the main brands all, you know, they build their catalogues. I don't even know what the word is. Their catalogues.
Brochures.
Their autumn winter collections or whatever it is around the Grand Slams. And Adidas appear to have had somewhat of a disaster.
Yeah, I was writing about it there and I thought it kind of looked like bleach had run through the T-shirt by accident and they just put it out anyway. A few of the players, so Federer, Nadal, Serena, Sharapova, I don't know how long that'll last, where they get specific clothes, but generally the rest of all the players wear the same kit, and unfortunately then they play against each other. I think Nike's kit was quite nice, but yeah, Adidas one was an absolute shocker. Kind of white with this black streaks all over it, and yeah, it didn't come out well on TV.
It's remarkable how this has got into sport now. Like, even how many, like...
Oh, it's the very same with golf.
But like Ricky Fowler, Rory, a few of them will now tweet on a Wednesday, here's what I'm wearing for the week.
Yeah,
you know, if unlike you win, the rest of us, who just see what falls out of the wardrobe first
win,
in the
you
morning.
Want to buy Rory's shirt.
Part of the aura of Tiger Woods was he was so immaculately dressed when he was winning all that, the Sunday Tiger Woods with the red t-shirt. Like, you know, he looked, the presence was everywhere of how he played and how he looked.
Yeah, I'd love to know the percentage of red shirts they sold compared to any other color.
Yeah, I would say it's up there.
That's where it's at. It's the same. It's the same at Port Rush with Nike this year.
Yeah, well, there's something for us to Google as the soccer match plays out later on. Stephen, thank you very much for joining us in the studio. We got through a lot. Stephen Higgins, you can read his work on crosscourtview.com.
Game on
2FM. Weekdays from 6.